Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
It's fair to say Judd Apatow is a certifiable comic genius. As a stand-up, screenwriter, producer, and director, he's been the creative force behind a slew of blockbuster films, including The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and breakthrough TV shows like Freaks and Geeks. He's written and edited a series of best-selling books, including his latest, This Is Gary Shandling's book, about his brilliant late comic mentor. And he's been a force behind Funny or Die. But sit down with Judd Apatow, and what you quickly learn is that he's also an amazingly thoughtful and insightful guy. I love this conversation we recorded late last year at his studio in L.A. Judd Apatow, it is great to see you. To sit down, I've admired you from a distance for a long time, so it's
Thank you.
To see you. Thanks for being here. One of the reasons I wanted to sit down with you is I am fascinated by comedians, by people who work in that area, and one of the reasons I'm fascinated is that, first of all, it turns out comedy is a very serious business.
It is very serious. Deadly serious.
But comedians, almost always, there's a story there, mm-hmm. and it's generally not a happy story.
Yeah, generally, yes.
And you would fit right into that. And I read a poem that you wrote when you were 15 called Divorce, saying, "For me, there was separation with lots of tears, going out with my friends, marijuana and beers. I cover my pain with silly jokes, no more drugs or beer, just Cokes. Maybe one day I'll be a big star driving around in a big car, and I won't mind that my parents split because it helped me write my comedy shit."
That's
First of all, I don't understand why you didn't go into poetry.
Do you know I never wrote another poem again? I was just going through some old stuff. I think I was 15 when I wrote that. And it's clearly a sad cry for help and kind of hilariously vulnerable in the way teenagers are. But I never wrote another poem again.
Yeah.
I didn't sit down and go, this is kind of fun writing poems. Poems were dead to me as soon as that one was over.
That's good, because this one is insightful.
Yes.
But it's not exactly Robert Frost. You know,
I was just getting my sea legs. Imagine how good I'd have been if I never stopped writing those poems.
But I was interested in your story. It's not unlike my own. My parents had a very unhappy marriage. They split up when I was five. They tried to get back together. They split up again. Lots of fighting, yes. Lots of discomfort. And that was sort of your childhood in Syosset,
for
New
a period.
York.
And I think that when you're young, you don't really understand what's happening. And, you know, my parents were really not happy with each other, let's say. So you're exposed to a lot of that. I think that you feel weird because you're like them and they don't like each other. Mm-hmm. And you feel like, well, if you don't like dad, I'm kind of like dad. I'm half dad.
Yeah.
And vice versa. So I think it makes you feel weird. I also noticed later in life that there was a lot of guilt about enjoying myself, because if I was with my dad and what became my stepmother having a great time, my mom was mad. She felt that.
And you lived with your dad, right?
I lived with my dad. My mom moved to Southampton, and I lived with my dad.
And so your sister lived with your mom?
Everyone kind of moved around, but my sister moved in with my mom. My brother moved in with my grandparents in California. Everything kind of broke apart. And so it was just odd. And then, you know, when your parents are getting divorced, suddenly they're single people in the world. So you're not just seeing your parents split up, you're seeing them dating, and you're getting a sense of what their needs are and what's unmet and how they feel about their lives and their journeys. And it's a lot of adult information.
Yeah, which is a burden on kids to have to confront all of that.
And years later, I said to my mother, you have to go to therapy. You're so neurotic and manic. You have to go to therapy. And I finally got her to go. And she walked out and she said, he told me I was right about everything.
So she signed up for another session.
Yeah. So when you have my mom was hilarious, but a little manic and unpredictable and kind of an amazing but peculiar woman. She was very materialistic. So, you know, we were upper middle class and then we weren't. And my mom, whenever she had money, she would spend it. And so at one point I gave her some money and she leased a Mercedes. And I said, why don't you get, you know, like a Camry or something so you don't have to worry about your bills? And she goes, 'cause I'm not an animal. But then I found out later that my grandfather, who was a jazz producer who produced Charlie Parker and Janis Joplin, that he was gone a lot. And so when he would come back from the road, he would bring her a dress. And after she died, someone explained to me that her materialism was about love, that's how her dad said he was sorry for being gone a lot.
Interesting, yeah.
And so having a nice car wasn't really about having a nice car. It was like feeling loved in the world. And she liked nice things because that's how she connected with her father in probably a very unhealthy way. There's a lot of guilt in our tribe.
So it's yes.
And that made me nervous and made me want to get a job. I mean, that's to sum up.
Yeah.
I thought, I need to make money. My parents are fighting. They're kind of going broke fighting each other. I think I need to take care of myself. And so at a ridiculously young age, I decided to try to be a comedian and a writer. And I started.
And how'd you land on that? I mean, did you just, you decided I just think, that baseball wasn't in your future? And
yeah, I wasn't good at sports. And I'd sit home and watch Merv Griffin and the Dinosaur Show religiously, which is weird for a 10-year-old. But I loved it. I loved 1970s show business. And
the Dinosaur Show, that Freaks and Geeks, there was an episode there was a scene of a kid watching
the Dinosaur
Show, watching Gary Shandling, I think.
Yes, and what that was about was what I did as a kid. My dad would be at work. I'd go home. I'd make myself a grilled cheese sandwich, and I'd slice a piece of chocolate cake and a glass of milk, and I would alternate between grilled cheese sandwich and the cake, and then I would watch the Dinosaur Show like all 10-year-olds do. But looking back, I mean, I know this sounds weird. It was some of the most fun times. I mean, it's just me hanging out with Mike Douglas and Lucille Ball and Yoko Ono.
Yeah.
And
there's nothing wrong with chocolate cake and grilled cheese sandwiches.
You know what? I wish I could do it now. I wish the girth wouldn't happen. But so I wanted to get out of this strife and into show business and comedy in some way. So I started interviewing comedians kind of like
on
this.
On your high school radio station.
Yeah, because there were no podcasts in 1983, 84. And I wanted to hear young comedians like Leno and Seinfeld talk at length about what comedy was and why they did it.
And they were willing to do it.
I think because no one wanted to talk to them. I don't think that anyone cared. Like now, every comedian's nightmare is that their friend says, could you be on my podcast? But back then, there was no long-form interviews for young comedians. No one was asking Gary Shandling to talk for an hour about the art of comedy. Yeah.
You know, there was this documentary a few years ago. I think it was called Comedian, and it was about Seinfeld trying to reconstitute his act after his show ended. And it was actually really brutal to watch.
It is. It is brutal. It's scary.
You've experienced that. Yeah.
Well, I did stand up from the time I was 17 till I was 24. Then I stopped because I just was getting more writing work. And I felt like the world was telling me, you should be a writer. And then
you came out here to USC.
I came out to USC and studied screenwriting, but mainly because there was no major for stand-up.
Yeah.
And I was really into stand-up, and then at some point I stopped because I was getting work. I created the Ben Stiller Show with Ben, and suddenly that was taking off, and I took it as a signal.
What about the thing that struck me about that documentary was he went to these little clubs with his yellow legal pad with jokes that he had written, and he'd try them out. And a bunch of them bombed. I mean, people would boo.
Yeah, and that's what it is. And he's, many would say, the greatest ever. And people might cheer for the first minute or two and give him a break on the first joke or two. But how quickly you can bomb even as everyone's favorite comedian is ridiculous. Also because the expectation is high. And if you're trying out new things and most of them are kind of clunky, you're going to fail. And so you're not just getting this comedian isn't funny. You're getting my favorite comedian of all time isn't funny.
I mean, I do a lot of public speaking. Mm-hmm. I try and tell a few jokes.
Yes.
There's always that a little bit of apprehension that the thing that you think is funny is going to create just a wall of stares.
Yes.
And discomfort. And it's a little frightening, actually.
I think so. But I mean, I think like when you make a speech, I guess if it's, you make a political joke and it doesn't go well, that could be very embarrassing because you're out there with an idea that you believe
but
no, in.
But I'm not there to be a comedian, so I guess if I fail on that level.
It's not that shocking because most people in politics don't do it at the highest level. Like when I worked at on the correspondence dinner and gave some jokes that were performed, I was just amazed at how good he was at stand-up, that the president... Clearly, we're not talking about Trump here.
Yes. Although, Judd Apatow, you have to take some responsibility for the current events because you participated in maybe the most famous Obama White House Correspondents' Dinner routine ever, which was 2011. Donald Trump was sitting in the audience. I think I was two tables away from him and watched as his face as these jokes landed.
So you were paying attention to him as it was happening.
You couldn't help but do it because they were so brutal. But one particular joke was the president recounting some of the highlights of that season from The Apprentice in the context of leadership.
It was condescending.
It was, yes, I would say that's fair. I think it was interpreted that way. Yes. It was your joke.
Well,
you and John Lovett worked this up together.
We did. You know, I went to the correspondence dinner the year before that. And I was touring the White House, and suddenly John Lovett, at the time speechwriter for the president, walks out of a room and says, I'm in there writing the correspondence jokes for the president. And I thought he would then say, come on in. Oh, my God, this will be so fun. You write jokes on a professional level. And instead, he just said, well, nice to meet you, and sent me packing. And so at the party, I was like drunk. I'm like, that was brutal. You should have led me in that room. What's the matter with you? The president needed my jokes. Of course, he didn't because he murdered. It was ridiculous. But the next year, John, contacted me and said, do you want to help out? And we, had a conversation about the speech. Most of it was written. And he was asking me, like, what else do you think it needs? And we were trying to figure out if there was a topic that wasn't covered. And I just said, I think you went too light on Trump. This birtherism thing is about his...
It was right when Trump was pressing the birtherism thing.
Yes. And so, and he was also considering running for president at that time.
Yes. In fact, I have to tell you, I walked in the room that night and he was talking to someone and I overheard the conversation as I walked past and he was saying, yeah, I know it's crazy, but like I'm on top in the polls.
Yeah.
So
he was tracking it already.
Oh, yeah. I have no doubt.
So we had this conversation and we decided, let's try to write tougher Trump jokes because we felt he deserved it because of the birtherism thing. And we didn't want him to run for president. So I pitched John this idea that maybe you could just have the president recount an episode of The Apprentice and talk about what a great job Trump did. And then John and I think some other writers put together the best episode explanation. And then later that night, Seth Meyers
decimated the president.
He was brutal. They were much, much more vicious jokes. And they were incredible jokes. And
I remember one of his jokes was... Donald says that he gets along well with the blacks. He's, but I don't think so unless the blacks are the white family that lives next door.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
One after the other.
All of them turned out to be correct. Like what the point of that joke is correct. And all those jokes about his ineptitude or whatever were right. And then afterwards, someone wrote a book and in the book, they tried to say that was the night that Donald Trump decided to run
for
president.
No, I honestly think you may be responsible.
Well, you know what?
You told me you had a little insomnia last night. Maybe this was what was keeping you up, your conscience.
I've got enough guilt as a Jew. I don't need to be responsible for Trump. But he was always trying to figure out if it was the moment to run for president for decades.
Right.
And so I actually do not think that that
no,
is
I
the
don't
case.
Either. I don't either.
But if it is the case, I'll take the hit.
Let me ask you about another brush with greatness you had when you were a kid, which was with Steve Martin.
Yes.
You sort of staked him out, wanted to get an autograph, I guess outside his home or something?
In 1978, I was 10, 11 years old, and that's when Steve Martin was just on fire with the Jerk and his stand-up and being on Saturday Night Live and his albums. And I was pretty obsessed, as obsessed as you can be with an artist of any kind. And so I've told this story a lot. I feel bad for him that I'm always telling it, but it is a weird, great story, is that I was visiting my grandmother and I would always make her drive by his house. No matter where we were going, I would say, can you drive by Steve Martin's house? Which for some weird reason, I knew where it was. And I'm 13 years old. And then one day we drive by and he's just sitting out front. I think he might've been washing his car. And I asked him for his autograph, and he said, I don't sign autographs at my house because then people will come all the time. Because he was like—
Not unreasonable.
He was like Beyonce in this moment.
Yeah,
and I said, well, why won't you sign it in the street? And so he just kind of laughed, but then didn't. And he said, I'm sorry. And he was very sweet. But then I got mad and wrote him this letter that said, Dear Steve, you're the funniest man in the world, but you treat your fans like garbage. And if you don't send me an apology, I'll send your address to Homes of the Stars and you'll have tour buses passing by 24 hours a day. And then I put it in his mailbox, no stamp. How, that's so stalkery. And I didn't think much of it. And like 3-4 months later, I got a book. He had written a book called Cruel Shoes of Short Stories. And he wrote in it, to Judd, I'm sorry, I didn't realize I was speaking to the Judd Apatow.
Yeah.
And so it's just a weird thing that I made him laugh. That's what I thought. That's what I took from it. That he would not have sent the book unless my letter attacking
him. You ever
him.
Had a conversation with him about this?
I have. And also we took a photo for Vanity Fair once, recreating it in the reverse where he is with the tour bus knocking on my door. And, you know, it's one of the great moments of your life having that experience to take the photograph with him. But I think it was for me, I'm not religious, but you have those things that you realize, oh, because he did this for me, it made me believe that my dream was possible because the guy I thought was the funniest guy in the world acknowledged me.
Yeah.
And it just shows, you know, the power you have to affect other people.
Well, you've been a great mentor to a lot of young talent. Was that a formative thing for you? Do you think back to that and say, this is a responsibility of success?
Sure, because I was also an autograph freak. I was always trying to meet people and get Billie Jean King's autograph or Robert Conrad. And so I had a lot of interactions with people, and some people were, you know, sweet. And when they were sweet, you would remember it for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
You know, even if it was like, you know, Bobby Nystrom from the Islanders was so cool. And part of your brain just goes, oh, this is what you're supposed to be with people. It's you're lucky that they, you know, buy anything that you do. And if they want to say hello, you should be happy to do it.
Michael Deaver, who worked for Ronald Reagan, told me a story that was really kind of revealing about Reagan, where Reagan was coming out of a hotel in New York and he was with him. And some guy ran up and said, and he named a different actor. I can't remember which actor. I think maybe Robert Mitchum or somebody. And he said, can I have your autograph? And Reagan took the thing and signed the guy's autograph, the name that the guy thought he was. And Deaver said, well, why'd you do that? And Reagan said, he thinks he got so-and-so's autograph. Yeah. He says he went home happy.
Yeah.
He said, you know, what's the big deal?
He should have wrote on it, I'm Ronald Reagan, and I'm going to end the Cold War in the future. This will be valuable as it predicts my future.
That would have worried the guy, I think. But so getting back to your journey, you had a teacher who encouraged you, the guy around the radio station.
Sure.
A teacher who said you could be another Woody Allen.
Yeah, I had a teacher named Jack DeMacy who ran the high school radio station, was a film teacher at our high school, Sasset High School. So I was like the station manager of this high school radio station. But I remember interviewing congressmen, and it was like kids having their own radio station. I don't know if the signal got far out of the parking lot, but we were running around being DJs. And playing jazz that no one likes to listen to. And then there was another teacher, an English teacher, who read something I wrote and encouraged me. I was supposed to write my biography, my autobiography, and instead I made something up, probably because nothing really good was happening in my life, yeah. And I didn't want to talk about it. So I just said that I was a CIA agent undercover at the school, and I started talking about all my romances with the teachers, and it was the kind of essay you could get in a lot of trouble.
Yes,
for.
These days that would start a whole set of investigations.
But she just said to me, "I think you're funny. You could be like Woody Allen. You should pursue that." And what's interesting is it's not like that. I liked that teacher, but it's not like I would have ever thought if that teacher said something nice to me, yeah. It could change my entire outlook on myself.
Yeah.
And in a weird way, it did. It was an adult saying, yeah, this worked. You should do more of this.
Yeah. So Seinfeld, you mentioned you interviewed him. He did an interview sometime in the last few years. And he said, the only place that I really feel comfortable is on the stage, which I thought was really interesting. Do you understand that?
I do understand it, but I've been around him, and I think he seems comfortable. I've had meals with him.
Well, maybe comfortable with other comedians.
Yes. I mean, he's a very nice man. What I think he's discussing is when you're on stage and it's going well, like you're very present. Mm-hmm. You can't think about anything else. And he's a very serious meditator. And there's something about this stage that it's relaxing because the problem you're dealing with is very specific and you can't think about anything else in your life while you're there.
And I guess that gets down to the core thing. Is it a way of getting away from unpleasantness?
I always talk about this with people because I feel like, you know, some people do it for healthy reasons, some people do it for unhealthy reasons. It's hard to judge each person's experience of doing it. Clearly, there's one reason to do it, which is you're needy and you need a few hundred people to say, you're okay. But also there's, in the best form, it's just an expression of who you are and your creativity. And it's a way to connect with people. So when it's working really well, you're having a conversation with people in a way you would never have in life.
And when it's not?
And when it's bad, it really depends on how it's bad. Sometimes you try new jokes and the crowd hates it and it makes you laugh. Like you get off and you're like, oh my God, that was brutal. And you're amused by the brutality of it. Other times when you feel disconnected on stage and you feel the audience just go, this ain't happening. And you just lose the thread on it. That's depressing. But if you succeed most of the time, it doesn't bother you that much. It's when you're young and you're awful and the only way to get better is to do it all the time. But for a while, you're awful almost every night.
Yes.
And then you wonder, should I stop?
Yeah.
And most people do
maybe
stop.
Maybe I am awful.
Yeah. And they are. They are awful. But, you know, a few people fight past that and then they figure it out. But for a while, it makes you question your very essence. And if it's your dream and it's going bad, it's scary.
So you found your way into writing, ultimately producing, directing. You mentioned the Ben Stiller Show, which was critically acclaimed, won an Emmy and
yes.
All of that. What did you learn from that experience? You said 23 at the time.
I was very young when it happened. You know, I got the job almost by accident. I had been producing people's stand-up specials, but I'd never done any sketch work. I'd never been on a staff of
one
a show.
One of the people was Roseanne Barr.
I did. I wrote Roseanne's act with her during that era of the National Anthem incident.
Yes.
And I would, you know, I was like a kid, and I would go to her house and write jokes at her breakfast table.
And then she asked you to expand your role with her, write her special.
Then she put me on full-time for a year to, you know, a lot of that work is typing. You know, when you sit with someone like Roseanne, what she really wants is somebody that she's comfortable being herself around who will not forget to write down the brilliant things that she says and then maybe could organize them or ask certain questions to get her going because you're trying to get someone else's mind excited to flow and be creative. So I did write some jokes, but it was mainly dictation.
She, obviously, her life has taken a kind of dark turn, a sad turn. You're very much associated with, on the political side, with progressive.
Yes.
Forever. In fact, ran as a left candidate for president or something at one point. What is your feeling as someone who knows her watching of this?
I remember when I first started writing for Roseanne, I said, I can't write jokes for you if I don't know you well. And it was a weird thing to do as a kid to go, can I interview you for a while? Like we did maybe 5-6 hours. just asking her about her life. So years before she wrote her autobiography, where she talked about, you know, issues of abuse and mental illness and multiple personalities, she told me about it. Just was very real and vulnerable with me and said, you can't tell anybody. And then years later, she wrote a book and explained it all. So she's clearly had very substantial issues with her mental health. And she's a great person. I mean, she's always wonderful to me. But you do wonder if there's like a tape loop in her head that gets set off around certain issues. And then she loses herself. Because it's not the Roseanne that I spent a lot of time with back then. All the ideas are different. She was a radical, almost punk rock feminist. So it's not just what she got in trouble for. There's a lot of areas where her thinking has evolved in a way that I don't think she would have appreciated as a younger person.
Interesting, because caricatures grow up, and this is one of the harsh things about our culture now, is you only know people in one way, and most people are much more complex than the picture.
Yes.
So.
Well, especially Roseanne. There's a lot going there. She's a genius. She changed television. She spoke to people that are never spoken to in her creative work.
Yes.
But there's other things happening with her mind, and I can't define what it is. So I'm not making excuses for her, but it's not just a person with clear opinions. There are other challenges that she has.
You know, you said she spoke to people who hadn't been spoken to. And I assume you're talking about people like in middle America.
Yes,
I wanted to ask you about Hollywood in this period, mm-hmm. because there is, you know, clearly a strong sense of antipathy toward President Trump. You see it at the awards ceremonies. You know, every one of them seems to be a little bit of a beatdown on him. And I often wonder how that is perceived in middle America, even around this whole impeachment thing. You see the president saying, this isn't just an assault on me, it's an assault on you. I mean, is there a disconnect here? And sometimes I wonder whether Hollywood is, in terms of the cause of making the case against the president, helpful or hurtful in that regard.
Well, there's clearly a very big disconnect in thinking, and we're all trying to understand why that is. For instance, I always think, why does anybody think Donald Trump has their back? Like, do they think he's really up late at night trying to solve your problems, that his heart aches for your situation? And so,
that's interesting.
As a Democrat, you know, one of the things we do is if somebody's awful, we make fun of them because we don't want people to be awful. And, you know, people of every ideology do that. And he certainly deserves it. If you love him, I'm sure any anti-Donald Trump joke is super annoying or enraging.
But some of it isn't jokes. Some of it are like speeches and
sure.
denunciations. And I think he uses it.
Well, he certainly has amazing instincts as a communicator. He truly understands flooding the zone. And what I always wondered, I'm sure one day we'll find out, is how much of his style of communication is something that he understands. And also,
I always call it a feral genius.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it is an instinct. I don't think he sits down and does deep analysis. He is impulsive and instinctive, but he has a feral instinct for how to particularly exploit people's sense of loss, of aggrievement. He's underestimated, I think, frankly, by elites. He understands that market that
yes.
Roseanne talked to.
Promoting probably casinos and taking all those people's money. You know, if you sit around the casino floor, I'm sure everyone's happy to chat with Donald. And he probably has a great sense of how to talk to people. But, you know, what it really comes down to is those people didn't get the tax cut. And so he didn't come through for anybody. He came through for, you know, for himself and for a group of people and corporations that didn't really need that. And I just see him as someone that is betraying their loyalty.
Yeah. I think that what he works is the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And he is the cultural avenger. For people who've been left behind in the economy and also feel disdained in the culture, and he gets that, and he's says, I'm your guy. I'm sticking it to those people who are sticking it to you. Back in the day when we were campaigning Obama, when we were in some sticky wicket or another, turned to me and said, you know, this shit would really be interesting if we weren't right in the middle of it.
Yes.
And I kind of feel that way as an American. I mean, it's interesting to watch, but we're right in the middle of it.
And it's very scary because we've never had a leader like this who relishes in cruelty. So last night, you know, when he's making jokes about Representative Dingell.
This will be heard in January, but we're speaking the day after the impeachment vote, and the president went to Michigan and was very—
And insulted the late Representative
Dingell.
Yeah. And his wife was very upset about
Who was his successor in Congress. He was obviously mad. His whole deal was he had lowered the flag for Dingell, and now she voted for impeachment. And it was classic. It was really revealing about Trump because he kind of feels like, well, I lowered the flag for your husband, so why would you vote to impeach me?
Well, it's very much a casino owner. It's like, I gave you a free round of beers.
Yeah.
You know, so much of his behavior is about that.
He's transactional.
Yes, and he thinks if he, you know, gives you the appropriate honoring, that you need to ignore extortion. And what I find most fascinating is, does he actually believe any of that? And are there people who now understand what he's doing in terms of flooding people with so many troubling moments of behavior that you don't care about anything?
Yeah. You know, I think a few things. One is, I think that he keeps things, though there's a lot of chaos reigning around him, he keeps things pretty simple. His storyline is always fairly simple. You know,
But does a speechwriter know if I say that Representative Dingell might be in hell, does Trump or the people around him know that on the day of impeachment that will take 20% of the news?
That is just the price of admission with Trump. Yes. I mean, I think, you know, he's an improvisational stand-up himself. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I mean, I wrote yesterday morning that, you know, they had obviously put that crazy letter out the day before impeachment, but the White House at least got to see it before it went out. You knew that night something was going to happen because he was provoked, and 2 hours of stand-up, you're going to have some lines that are like that with Trump. I think they just, you know, ultimately, I think his greatest liability going into this election is this sensory overload, that the tweets, the tantrums, the gratuitous fights that never end, the chaos, and the exhaustion that results from it. And I think that sense of exhaustion could end up doing him in, because he's only going to get more frenetic as this campaign goes on. But I would in no way underestimate him as a candidate, but we digress.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, what he may not understand is that he is an entertainer first, and in America, people get bored with talent. And so at some point, they turn on Game of Thrones. At some point, they turn on The Sopranos. No matter how great you are, like, they want new product. They're sick of your shtick. And that's, you know, this is a guy when he was running for president, by the end was telling the crowds, I will make all your dreams come true.
Yes.
And at some point, people have to do the math. Did my dreams come true? Like, what happened to me?
But I think that because the dreams didn't come true, there is a need to start fires that are distracting. And he does do that. We're going to take a short break. Stay tuned for more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. You evidence your experience with show business and mm-hmm. how the market reacts. You went from the Ben Stiller Show to the Larry Sanders Show, mm-hmm. worked with Gary Shandling, who was a mentor of yours, and then you did a show called Freaks and Geeks that was a spawning ground for a lot of young talent, Seth Rogen and others. And then you went on this string of, like, incredibly successful movies. I think I read somewhere that you had, the course of a decade, 12 movies that grossed more than $100 million. Variety said you were the king of comedy. So you were a relatively young guy. Now you're the king of comedy. This formerly little schlub from Syosset.
Still, well, fatter.
How'd you process all of that? And did you feel like the king?
Well, I had an interesting journey in my work, which is I had a lot of work get rejected early in my career. So Freaks and Geeks was canceled before the first season was over. The Ben Stiller Show was canceled. Undeclared was canceled. I had a lot of pilots not get picked up.
How'd you take that?
Not well. I mean, there was tears and therapy, and I had back surgery. I was, you know, wound very tight back then. I was popping discs, and then I did, you know, a movie called Heavyweights, which we like, which is on Disney Plus right now, but it didn't do well. And then I did The Cable Guy, which I loved and still do.
Met your wife there. That's one reason to.
Yes, that's why I met Leslie. And then that didn't do as well as people hoped. So I was on a run of things not doing well. So when things finally started doing well, and I was in my 30s at that point, it was a little easier for me to appreciate it because I never had anyone go to the movie in the numbers they wanted before. And I had written a lot of things, and my friends had also, that we couldn't get anyone to make. So as soon as, you know, one or two of the movies were hits,
people say, well, maybe we'll do this.
Yeah, well, what do you got in the draw? And you know, some of that was some of the best stuff that people were afraid of before we proved that maybe someone would go to these movies.
And you did The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up. I could just go on and on with these list of hits. A lot of them seem to derive from elements of your own life and experience, just as the grilled cheese sandwich and chocolate.
What are you saying about The 40-Year-Old Virgin?
I'm not going to go there.
Well, shame. I understand shame. Yes, a lot of it was personal, and it took me a very long time to realize that that's where the best stuff was. I thought you just thought of funny movies like Ghostbusters, and you write jokes, and it wasn't, you know, from the heart. I don't think I understood that for a few years into my career, that the best work was very deeply personal. And so when I did that scene for Freaks and Geeks where I showed Bill watching Gary Shandling and laughing by himself, my friend Jake Kasdan, who was a producer and director of the show, he said, oh, that's the best thing you've ever done. And then I realized, oh, I guess that's what you're supposed to do, is open up to people.
Do you think of yourself, how do you think of yourself? Do you think of yourself primarily as a writer, as a producer, as a director, as a stand-up? A couple of years back did a special reconstituting your stand-up.
I think of myself as just someone with worse Twitter habits than the president. That's how I'm active. Yes. But you know, for me, I just love comedy, so I might drift towards movies or TV or doing stand-up, but I love all of it. I get a real kick out of it, and I also like the friendships with all the people that you get to collaborate with. It's, you know, it's a lot of really
some
fun
of the guys
people.
You hung around with as a young comedian were, you know, Adam Sandler and Jim Carrey and so on. You once said opening for them was like opening for you too.
Yes, it made you feel terrible about your own abilities because people don't have that experience. Oh, I'm hanging out with my friend, but my friend happens to be one of the legendary people of all time in his embryonic form.
Yeah.
And you could feel the energy around it. I mean, I haven't really seen it since Adam Sandler and Jim Carrey, where you feel the world gravitating towards them even before it happens. Just as a energy force, you'd walk in a party with them and the party would just move towards them, just charisma and talent. And so it made me feel like maybe I should write, because I could write jokes for them, but I can't do what Jim Carrey's doing up there. Then yeah. Later in life, I thought, well, maybe who I am is fine.
Yeah.
I don't have to be able to do what Jim does.
Yeah, I can't think of anybody who, I remember, you know, Robin Williams,
yeah.
He came and did an event for Barack Obama when he was running for the Senate. The frenetic energy was interesting though, before he was almost in a trance-like state before the thing began, and after he was quite withdrawn. But on the stage, he was manic and he was brilliant. I mean, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, we'll never know what it takes to be able to do that.
Yeah.
To be able to think that quickly.
Yeah.
Because I go online sometimes and I'll just Google Robin Williams and look at YouTube videos, and there's just performances up there. And someone will say, the funniest Robin Williams clip ever. And there's like 200 of them from
yeah.
different people. And it's him at, you know, an army base in Afghanistan or Iraq, just murdering, just being so funny and rolling with a weird situation and things that come up.
Goes back to my original point with him, you know, such a tragic story. He brought all this joy to people and couldn't find peace himself. And he had
Lewy body disease.
And
there's no way to really know how that factored in, because it was someone whose joy came from the fact that his mind worked so well and his body worked so well. And I think as someone who's getting sick and having a disease, which also gives you delusions, I'm sure it was also a very large factor, like there wasn't something very serious going on. Because I you know, he definitely struggled in ways a lot of creative people struggle with addictions and depressions.
It's, yeah.
You know, it is a common thing, and I think because creative people feel a lot of pain, and then they also are empathetic and compassionate, and they can see other people's pain because they have it, and they can write about it or write songs.
Well, you would be in that category. I mean, you've struggled with anxiety. And,
yes.
And you've been pretty open about it, which I applaud, by the way. I mean, I talk a lot about the fact that my dad committed suicide, and I do it primarily because people need to know that mental illness and challenges are pretty pervasive, and they need to know it's okay to get help. It's not a mark of character.
Yes, I started going to therapy in my early 20s, and I only wished it started when I was 12. I'm fascinated by pop psychology, real psychology, anything to do with thinking about why you behave the way you behave. And I also think, by the way, not to bring it back to politics, it is what is so fascinating about the president is it's a combination of personality factors that we've never seen before. We can feel his pain. We can feel his neediness. We can tell where he's broken. It's all very transparent. We know his story. We probably can't even imagine the type of psychological or you know, physical abuse.
His father told him there are two kinds of people in the world. There are killers and there are losers. So what's the message there?
And so that's what, as a country, we're watching a TV show, and the TV show is like, it is like The Sopranos. Yeah. It's the guy who was raised by that guy and is trying to get love from somebody. He's trying to fill a hole he can't fill.
Well, you can see at those rallies how he drinks in the all of that, you know.
And at the rally, he can talk nonsense, and they applaud just because they're in rhythm with the speech. You know, one thing I like to do is watch the people standing behind him. Because if you really watch them carefully, after 10 or 15 minutes, you know, he talks for 90 minutes,
they glaze over.
And then they start reacting for real. Like, they seem horrified. Like, they're, or they're just confused. Like, wait a second, a nice, good guy wouldn't say that. And I think he is a source of endless fascination because we all feel like we're in danger. But also, in a weird way, I think we feel for him. You can't help but see like a little kid whose dad treated him awfully, and now he's just trying to be a big man. And it's so obvious. There was a great interview where he talked about the fact that he never went to therapy, and he was proud of it. And you could feel it. There's no sense of introspection. There's no part of his mind that imagine what it's like to be a kid separated from his or her parent. Like, what would that feel like? What would it do to you? That's what I think terrifies us, because he's not tuned in as a caring soul. And then we all wonder, well, where does that go?
Yeah, well, I think we're getting a sense of it. So, I mentioned Leslie Mann, your wife.
Yes.
You met on The Cable Guy. You've been married for 20 years or so. 23 years. How hard was it to learn how to be married, given the experience you had as a kid?
Well, the main issue that I brought into it is a certain type of hypervigilance. And I think it makes you be on the lookout for trouble. What's going to happen? How do we stop it? How can I think about every bad thing that could happen and prevent it before it happens? And what that does is it makes you not very present. Also, it makes you think that work can solve your problems, that if I work and I succeed, I have safety or I have happiness. And it actually takes your success to realize that none of that is true, that your success only clears a bunch of stuff away that reveals what your true wounds are that you need to deal with or whatever you're struggling with.
You have a couple of children, Maude and Iris.
Yes.
Maude is now an actress.
Yes, she's on Euphoria on HBO.
Did your work and this sort of compulsion you had to work, did it take you away from them?
There were periods where I worked more because I had never had a hit. So you start thinking, I really got to put the time in here, because if I don't get a hit soon, I'm not going to be a part of this business anymore. And then it's what everyone's dealing with. How many hours are you at work? You know, a movie's a weird thing because you get there at 6 a.m. and you shoot till 7 or 8 at night. And what if the set's an hour and a half away? And so Leslie and I have very carefully scheduled the best times to do it. So this summer I shot a movie with Pete Davidson from Saturday Night Live. Yeah. And I just schedule to shoot it during the summer when my daughter wants to talk to me less anyway. And it's been decades of that.
I felt like I cheated my kids when I was coming up in politics and trying to make my way and so on. You sort of, your worst battles with anxiety were at the sort of, when you really started reaching the peak of your
yes.
success. I mean, you know, I think I read somewhere about some transatlantic flight or something. Where
well,
you,
I mean, it's a ridiculous story. I was rewriting the film Happy Gilmore in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And my friend Adam Sandler, this was his second movie, and he wrote it with his friend Tim Hurley, and it was, you know, it was great, but they said, will you come up and help us like figure out some final problems and do some punch up on it? But as a young person, in my head, I thought, if this movie's bad, it's all my fault because they asked me to come help them figure out, you know, mm-hmm. how to get this ready to go. And I put so much pressure on myself over Happy Gilmore, which, you know, it's a classic, but I started having panic attacks. And the first panic attack I had was at my cousin's wedding. I sat down and a group of bridesmaids started singing the Bryan Adams song, All for Love, and my brain melted. And I my heart started racing, and I got claustrophobic, and I had
That's why I never listened to that song.
Exactly. It's Bryan Adams' fault. And for days, I had this terrible panic attack, and I didn't know what it was. And then I had a meeting with Lorne Michaels to punch up a Chris Farley movie. And I'm still having the panic attack. I don't know what it is. I think I'm going crazy. No one's like, oh, you're having a panic attack. No one ever said the words panic attack to me. And Lorne Michaels is explaining the fixes for the movie that he needs. You know, here's what's wrong with the story. What do you think about this story element? And the entire time I'm sitting with him for an hour, all I'm thinking is, I'm having a panic attack. I may have to leave. If I have to leave, I'll tell him I had bad Pollo Loco earlier. For an hour. And I'm talking to him and I'm pitching ideas, but that's really all I'm thinking is, you're sick from Pollo Loco. You're allowed to leave. And then I went to a therapist and he explained it to me. And it actually was part of my spiritual journey, is to just take care of my mind and meditate. And
is there an element of competing with yourself when you've had great success? Is there an element of A, thinking, what if I'm not as good as people think? And B, what if I never do anything as good as that?
I usually don't think that. I think the opposite. I think in my life, I always dreamed I would make something that was really great, that was as good as the movies I loved as a kid, you know, Stripes or something like that. And so when I had one or two things where I felt hit that bar, it actually makes me more relaxed to take chances because I feel like, well, at least I did it once. At least, you know, Freaks and Geeks is good, so I can relax on the new movie because I know it's possible we can do it again. And so it actually makes me feel better. I also feel like I've done a lot of stuff, and if people start, you know, turning on me, it's okay. I understand.
That's good.
It's been a while.
You mentored a number of young women in comedy, Lena Dunham and Amy Schumer, and you've also been very outspoken on this issue of how women are treated. You were very outspoken on Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby.
Yes.
Who is kind of an iconic figure in comedy before that. Why was that important to you?
I think for all of it, it is about creating an atmosphere where women will feel like they're going to be supported if they stand up and speak their truth. And that atmosphere wasn't there, especially during the Cosby time when we were first learning what he did. And I felt like people were very slow to react, especially people who have, you know, a lot of fans. People really did not want to step into it. Well, but what it was, yeah, was creating silence to all these brave people who stood up. Like, there weren't people saying, I understand, I believe you. And it was a bit heartbreaking for me. And so I thought, well, I can say I believe them. I mean, there's 60 people with the exact same story. And then I started meeting them. And the second they start talking about it, you could see it in their eyes. And he shattered these people. He affected the rest of their lives. And the least everybody can do is to say, I hear you. I think it's great that you are speaking up.
How pervasive are these problems? I mean, they are in our society, but in Hollywood, where there are all these power relationships.
I think it's, it's a bad setup. Like, I've got a job. You want it? That's a bad setup for people
especially
to get
abused. Highly competitive.
Yes, and a highly competitive world with, people whose psyches are not in control. And so with somebody like Harvey Weinstein, I was talking to his agent, and he said to me, we knew about this for years. Whenever I had an appointment with Harvey, he would always do the same thing. He would say it's going to be at the cafe at the hotel, and then say he's running late. Can we do it upstairs? And then let the assistants go. Like, they all knew what was happening. This one agent said to me, whenever I had a client see him, I always came with her. Like, we knew you don't leave your client alone with him. Now, some people probably made the mistake and did. But it wasn't a secret in this town the way that some people want to say it was. People were actively trying to keep their clients away from him.
Look, the same is true in politics, we now know. I think often there was all this talk about the Clinton impeachment there and whether or not you thought he should have been impeached. You know, that was a deplorable thing. And I say that as someone who admired him as a president. He was very kind to me. But we all kind of looked the other way.
Until you have a daughter who's that age, maybe you don't know what that age is like and what a power imbalance that is. What an abuse of trust to take advantage of somebody like that. It's not a normal affair. It is demented. And there was definitely reason to be concerned. And it's hard to judge what the penalty for that is. But I remember at the time being really horrified by it. And at the time, I remember just thinking to myself and saying to my friends, he should just step down now. Who wants the guy that's preying on the young girls in the office? Forget the lying, just doing it. You know, my daughter's 22. I know what that age is. I know how much they know. I know how adult they are. And if the most powerful man in the world is suddenly trying to charm you, well, it's very abusive. And it's also crazy. I mean, I watched that Monica Lewinsky documentary. I think it was on A&E. When they showed the layout of the offices, how far away he was from other people while doing that, it was really awful. And I thought he should just let Al Gore be the president, get out of the way. And people did not vote for Al Gore, partially because they were just bored of all the Clinton stuff. And so they just wanted something new. They wanted to change the channel in some way. And so I feel like the Democrats paid a price by not getting Al Gore to be the president.
Yeah. And also pay a little bit of a price now because it gets thrown back in everybody's face.
By the way, the Democrats were terrible about it. You know, the lack of interest in the abuse of power at that time was really disappointing. Yeah. People did not stand up for her. And only in recent years have people begun to say, wait, maybe that was really bad due to an intern.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Just generally, when you look at your industry and the country as a whole, how much do you think has changed as a result of Cosby, Weinstein, and some of these other...
I think a lot has changed already because there was never fear about doing it. And so now people feel like there are repercussions to this. I think that most people didn't think about, whether or not it was wrong to prey upon actresses. I mean, I don't know if you know the Warner Brothers scandal where the head of Warner Brothers Films, they set him up with a young woman and then in some sort of trade, they're going to get her auditions or promise her parts and things. And that's the story we know about. But, there's probably a lot more of that in the industry. There has been for 100 years. And that's the worst of our industry. But that guy did lose his job.
Yeah.
And I don't know if 10 years ago he would have lost his job.
Yeah.
And so there's probably a long way to go, but just the idea that people feel like I'll get destroyed by this, I'm sure it slows a lot of people down.
You've got a million projects, books, documentaries, this book that's sitting here, the Gary Shandling book, which is derived from his own writings. And
yes.
Tell me where your head is now in terms of future projects. Where do you see yourself going?
I just made a movie with Pete Davidson.
Yeah, you mentioned that. Tell me about that. He's an interesting guy.
He's fascinating. His father was a fireman who died on 9/11, and Pete has had a really challenging time around that. I think that the children of people who died have a very unique grieving challenge. Because in a way, it never goes away. The conversation never stops, nor should it. But it's not like with my mom. My mom died 10 years ago. Once or twice a year, someone mentions her. But I think around 9/11, a lot of those people, are the receptacles of other people's grief about it.
Right.
Because people are devastated. And so, right. So it becomes a grieving that doesn't really end.
Yeah.
And Pete and I and our friend Dave Cyrus wrote, hopefully, a good movie. It's not about 9/11, but it is about Pete's character losing his father in a fire, who's a firefighter. And it's a comedy about grieving, which we know everyone goes through. And I'm really proud of it. Steve Buscemi is in it, and Marissa Tomei and Bill Burr.
And when is that coming?
That comes out in June 19th.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I could talk to you forever.
That was fun.
I hope this is the beginning of more conversations. But
definitely.
Judd Apatow, great to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of The Axe Files is Emily Stanitz. The show is also produced by Miriam Annenberg, Samantha Neal, and Allison Siegel. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Courtney Coop, Megan Marcus, and Ashley Lusk. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.